This is David Wiley, Director of the African Studies Center, Professor of Sociology at Michigan State, and we're happy this afternoon to welcome to recount about their history at Michigan State both Annabelle Dwyer and David Dwyer, who have a long history and who have now retired from Michigan State. David has his PhD from Michigan State and became a professor of African languages, of African studies, and later of anthropology at Michigan State. And he coordinated the very innovative African language program at Michigan State, which brought almost 30 languages to graduate students and faculty that needed them for their field research in Africa, starting in about 1977-78. Annabelle Dwyer has her master's degree from Michigan State in urban planning and is a lawyer who's worked in human rights law, taught at Cooley Law School, and been an organizer for human rights issues in the greater Lansing and Michigan area for since the 1970s as well. So why don't we start, and can you tell us about yourselves? I mean, where are you from? Are you Michiganians, and where did you do your education and so on?
Well, I come from a village in Michigan called Ann Arbor, where my father was a professor there. And for the longest time, I thought that there was only one university in Michigan. And lo and behold, over the years, I discovered that not only was I a professor at the University of Michigan State University, but that there still was only one university in Michigan, which became Michigan State University.
Very good. And so where did you do your undergraduate work then?
My undergraduate work was at Michigan. Uh-huh. And then I came here and got we went into the Peace Corps, which is where I met Annabelle, and I'm sure she has some stories about that. But then we came back here, and I was invited by Charles Kraft and the late David Smith, who was a graduate student in anthropology, to help them write a textbook on Cameroon Pidgin English. And that gave me an assistantship and entree into the Department of Linguistics, where I got my master's and PhD.
Very good. And then after that, David, you came onto the faculty at Michigan State in which year was that?
That was 1973 as well. And initially I had a half-time appointment in anthropology, and that was put together with something like a third time in linguistics with support from African studies, and a sixth time in speech and audiology, where I taught phonetics courses. Mm-hmm. And then gradually this evolved into doing African languages for linguistics and African studies, and doing language and culture courses for anthropology.
And you were working primarily in which African languages?
My research was, even though I did some research on Cameroon Pidgin English, I began to focus on the Mande languages of Sierra Leone and Liberia. These are actually the southwestern Mande languages. Mande is one of the major branches of Niger-Congo, which spreads from Sierra Leone all the way east almost to Nigeria.
All right. And Annabelle Dwyer, tell us of your history.
Well, I'm from eastern Pennsylvania. Went to Wellesley College and majored in music, history, and theory, and decided to go in the Peace Corps because I came from a politically active family, and it was a very exciting kind of opportunity. David didn't say, by the way, that his brother and he were the people who helped to organize the Peace Corps and actually organized the campuses all over the country to write to Kennedy.
And to Senator and Hubert
to,
Humphrey.
Yeah, and to Humphrey.
He introduced the bill.
Well,
right?
Humphrey took it on, yeah. So that's why the Peace Corps was announced at the Michigan Union, because the Dwyer boys and a few other people in Ann Arbor actually put it together. So that, but I had done political organizing as a child, and I don't need to get into that, but was very interested in the Peace Corps, and we ended up in Cameroon together, so we'll tell some of those stories at the party tomorrow night. I don't think we need to go into those. I came back here and worked in Peace Corps Washington for a year and did a year of graduate work in anthropology at the University of Arizona. I had had some experience on the Navajo Reservation at a Friends Service Committee work camp before the Peace Corps. So I ended up in Michigan State with David. I have to confess I barely knew where Michigan was at that point, being an Easterner. But we came in here at a very exciting time, right at the Vietnam Project revelations, which didn't give Michigan State a very good reputation. And I got involved almost immediately in the Poor People's Campaign and in the anti-Vietnam War efforts. Here we helped found the Peace Education Center and went on from there for neighborhood environmental organizing, and always the Africa interest was part of the work we did. I became a lawyer only after Ronald Reagan made it pretty impossible for any real street organizing to go on. So
you obtained an additional master's degree at Michigan State then?
Right. I got a master's degree in urban planning with a focus on urban options, which we helped found, and appropriate technologies we had. Mm-hmm. That came out of not only the original energy crisis in the 70s, but also the emphasis on neighborhood organizing.
And your law degree was... At Cooley.
Yeah, I got a law degree from Cooley, and then I attended the Hague Academy of International Law, and I'm now a member of the Board of Directors of the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy, which is the U.S. branch of the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, and have spent, in addition to basic research, especially work on humanitarian law and human rights law, and have taught some mm-hmm. of that at Cooley. So I'm giving papers and defending resistors to nuclear weapons and trying to figure out what to do in this particularly terrible climate we're in at the moment.
So what did being Peace Corps in Sierra Leone, and what years were those in?
In Cameroon. Well, I was in the first Peace Corps group in Cameroon.
So that was 1962
to 1964.
Right. That was and after the first group went to Nigeria in 61.
Right.
I believe, right. So, okay.
And then there was another earlier group in Ghana, I think. Mm-hmm. I was 63 to 65, and Annabelle hasn't let me forget that.
I see. So what did being there in Cameroon in those early 60s days, right after independence in Africa, period in general of optimism about development writ large, what did that mean for you personally and how you came to view the world?
Well, it was interesting because more than I ever would have expected, we were welcomed by Cameroonians. In fact, they called us Kennedy brothers and sisters, almost as though we were nuns and priests in the service of John F. Kennedy, whom all Africans loved. And so his assassination was seen as real tragedy, and it was such that when that happened, the Cameroonians were hugging us and sharing their sorrow. And so there was a really strong bond there, and also a very strong sense of hope, of a strong, positive future. And it was even that way when we left. And the problems that Africa has encountered since then have been very, very moving and very sad. As far as us personally, or at least me personally, I had always been led to believe that people living in other parts of the world had entirely different cultures, so much so that they were really unapproachable as human beings. And I found out this was simply not the case, that there were people who believed different things from what I did. Of course, there are Americans who believe a lot different things than I do. But these were warm people that you could joke with, you could like a lot, not everyone. But it gave me a feeling of belonging to the world and not necessarily to my own country. And I think that was the major lesson I got out of that.
Mm-hmm. Canada?
I think, from my point of view, the early 60s in Cameroon or any of immediate post-colonial Africa was extremely exciting. There were all kinds of young Cameroonians who were becoming in charge of all the ministries, who were changing. For example, I taught in a women's teacher training college in upcountry West Cameroon in Bamenda, and the whole curriculum was being changed from the colonial kind of approach and European history approach to an African approach. All the examinations were changed, all the curriculum. We had to rely a lot on French textbooks, which was interesting. The West Cameroon was formerly Nigerian part of mandate to Nigeria, and that the whole question of the partition and reuniting of Cameroon is a historical question. But the west part of Cameroon was English-speaking, the eastern part was French-speaking, and in addition to 70 other languages and pidgins. So we had not only this very exciting period of transition in which the Peace Corps volunteers were in the education system used quite beneficially, I think, to actually change the curriculum. So while the missions were still in charge, they were no longer emphasizing Europe. In addition to that, the students were extraordinary. I taught everything from history, geography, to arithmetic, singing, and drawing, and we made our own gym, our own track field. You did all sorts of things. The musicians from the southern part of Cameroon were extremely exciting for me because I taught not only music but also actually trained the choirs, and we did a bunch of plays and all that sort of thing. But the whole math and history and the geography parts of it were just really exciting because the kids really knew all the English system, so they got caught on to the decimal system really quickly. They were very good at the math. The geography stuff, they really didn't know much about African geography, so we went into all kinds of ways of figuring out stuff. So it was an extraordinarily exciting period for me. I don't think we did any harm. I think we we learned an incredible amount and have very good friends from the time, and then went back to Sierra Leone.
And there was another Michigan connection in that this was the period that Governor G. Menin Williams, Kennedy's first Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, was going up and down Africa talking about Africa for the Africans. Mm-hmm. So it set a climate of the way Americans were perceived in the Peace Corps as well, I think.
Well, there's another Michigan connection, too, for me. I had heard at college not only Malcolm X speak, but also Jules Nyerere at a special seminar that Wellesley had. And as I was saying to Lioba Moshe last night, there really was no more inspiring person that I've ever heard than Jules Nyerere. And, he was only part of the whole very exciting group of Africans who had managed to end the colonial period. But, I'd had this sort of direct relationship with him, as well as with Malcolm X, who, of course, came from here.
Grew up here.
Well, yeah, he came from here. So,
he was on the football team in Mason, Michigan.
That's right.
I wanted to add one more thing to the logic of Peace Corps volunteers. Although I wasn't a teacher, I was doing community development. The logic of getting Peace Corps volunteers as teachers, even though they were generalists, was that it freed up a lot of young Cameroonians to go abroad and get their college degrees, mm-hmm. so they could return. And so this was a gap-filling process that was successfully fulfilled by the Peace Corps volunteers.
So did you get started in your interest in African languages in Cameroon, David? Is that the...
Well, when it came to... I knew I was going to go into the Peace Corps as soon as it got formed. And I tried to figure out where in the world I wanted to go, because you could go anywhere in the world. And I knew that wherever I went, it would be something that would be a lifelong commitment. And And so I said, well, this is a 21-year-old thinking, very ignorant 21-year-old thinking. I said, well, what about Asia? And my feeling was, well, you know, these people are so civilized and so polite, and I'm such a slob, I'd never fit in there. And then I said, well, what about Latin America? I said, oh, I don't know Spanish, and, you know, they've just been run over by Europeans anyway, just like the United States. So I don't want to go there. Well, what about Africa? I don't know anything about Africa. That's where I'll go. So this is the mind of a 21-year-old, mm-hmm. but I'm very happy with the decision.
Right. And so what languages did you work in Cameroon then?
Well, I worked primarily in Cameroon Pidgin English, although there were a number of other languages that were spoken there. And no sooner did I get there than I started working on a language called Wimbum, which is probably spoken by 25,000 people. And one of the first phrases I learned was Wedufe, which means where are you going? I and a friend of mine found ourselves hiking 20 miles between one town and the next. And some market women came by and greeted us, and I knew the greeting. And then they thought they'd throw in a stumper. And they said, Wedufe. And I just happened to know. It was the only phrase in that language I knew. And I said, well, Medunta. I'm going to market. And so they just fell on the ground laughing, and I couldn't believe this. But anyway, Cameroon Pidgin was the main language I worked with, and I ended up writing for the African Studies Center at Michigan State and the Peace Corps a textbook in the introduction to West African Pidgin English, which I understand, even though it's out of print, is still being used a lot.
Right, right. So then, coming back from the Peace Corps, what are the next steps? I mean, how do you get from there to teaching African languages at Michigan State?
Well, the first thing that happened was, as I mentioned earlier, getting this opportunity to write this textbook, and I began taking courses in linguistics and trying to decide, ironically, between anthropology and linguistics. And Charles Kraft, who was a Hausa teacher way back in the late 60s, talked me into linguistics, even though he had a joint appointment in anthropology. I had an undergraduate degree in anthropology. And so I got more and more interested in that. In terms of teaching African languages, it turned out that at that time, African languages were extremely popular because there were returning Peace Corps volunteers. Africa, as we mentioned, was a place of hope. And we had classes in Yoruba, Igbo, and several others that had 23 students in the class. And so I started getting involved in learning these languages. And then once I got my degree, there was a question of what I should be doing. And initially I was asked to teach a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a few languages. And actually it was the chair of anthropology that suggested to me, on the basis of a friend of his, that we consider this on-demand individualized instruction. And I think one of the first languages I did was not an African language, but Indonesian. And gradually this evolved and evolved, and then pretty soon somebody by the name of David Wiley came along, who among all the Africanist directors took the most serious interest in African languages and in promoting them. And I think that you had the first inclination that we needed to take on the teaching of African languages from a national perspective rather than an individual one. And in thinking back, you know, this was before the National Foreign Language Center. And so you are to be congratulated for that. You're also to be congratulated, be thanked for helping to push me in that direction. Because had you not, I probably wouldn't have stayed on at Michigan State University.
Okay. Well, so you end up teaching these languages in the mid-70s then, and then you you actually are named a half-time coordinator of the African language program.
Mm-hmm.
You're a full-time coordinator, but half of your appointment, mm-hmm. and the other half in the anthropology mm-hmm. department, mm-hmm. where you're teaching mm-hmm. anthropology of language,
mm-hmm.
right? And that goes on for the 70s and 80s and 90s then, mm-hmm. right? For this mm-hmm. almost, perhaps a 25-year period mm-hmm. In which you're serving in that and overseeing the offering of many African languages from a list of mm-hmm. between 20 and 27, I think, at very various times, according to the needs of the student. You want to describe what that program looked like? I mean, how it was tailored and individualized? And
Well, we gradually evolved the idea that we should have learner-centered programs that address the needs of individual learners. And as you hinted, it would be far better for a graduate student who is interested in Kikuyu, pottery, to speak Kikuyu rather than be told that you have to understand or you have to learn Swahili because that's the only language we offer. And so that was part of the tailoring of the language. The second thing we learned was that really what people needed to learn a language was exposure to the language, so that by putting a learner together with a native speaker of a given language, there was a lot of exposure to the language. That we learned that people often internalize things without having a full formal understanding of the grammar. That's not to say we didn't teach grammar, but it was really the practical exposure of listening, of practicing, of speaking that gave access to the language. And while we didn't, the tutors didn't have the formal training, although that was part of my job to help tutors and learners at the same time understand the learning process, the sheer amount of exposure in these one-on-one situations, as opposed to a situation in which you have one teacher and 25 students, meant that the amount of learning that was taking place was massive, and that the teacher was always responding to the individual need of that learner, as opposed to a generalized syllabus that was attempting to hit the average learner. And so we found that even though there were some shortcomings in the learning process compared to formal language teaching, that these students were learning as well, if not better, than in regular language courses.
And that was externally vetted in some mm-hmm. of the earlier years by people mm-hmm. who had not been part of the system from other universities
mm-hmm.
who found the learning was good
mm-hmm.
and perhaps exceeding that of classroom
mm-hmm.
Faculty-fronted courses at that time. So, so how many languages were you learning about and overseeing during that time? Have you ever counted all those?
No, but I think you said somewhere in the neighborhood of 30, and we have to remember that this really represents three different levels, because we would always try to get each graduate student exposed to a first year, a second year, and a third year. And by the end of the third year, we expected them to know enough language so that they could function in the field and continue to learn. But, I would say somewhere in the neighborhood of 30.
Right.
And so I can greet people in a lot of different languages and right. know a little bit about a lot of languages.
And you were going to the classrooms each week of each of those languages
mm-hmm.
seeing that they were going well. So a tremendous amount of labor involved in supervising.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And I've been meaning to sit down and try to write out the principles that one would use in observing a class and what one would do to suggest to students what they need to do next. But it was really based on observing what they were doing and suggesting different techniques that they would try out, as opposed to ordering people to do things.
Right. So out of that came a lot of graduate students, primarily more than undergraduates, with a lot of knowledge of the languages they were going to,
mm-hmm.
who then were taking that language knowledge into the national competitions for Fulbright Hayes, Fulbright, Social Science Research Council, other other awards for research in Africa. And I think as a testimony to the foundation you built there, now since the records were started being kept in 1983, this university has produced more PhDs on Africa than any other university, and it continues to do so, which both reflects the number of African students that were coming to Michigan State for learning education, agriculture, health, and anthropology, and other geography, other fields, but also to how well Michigan State students competed in the national competitions with that language in hand, which most American universities were not giving to their graduate students. So it's a really unique contribution.
Another testimonial to that is the fact that our FLAS students, who were African Studies students, have been center directors at Boston University, Ohio University, Indiana University. Are there any others?
Well, there are associate directors as well at Indiana and at Florida, and University of Florida, and so on. So I think they come out with an immersion in Africa. When you look back at this academic career in anthropology and African languages, are there ways in which that you wish it were different, that you wish the situation were different than what you, as you look back over this 30-year history in languages in Africa?
Wish I had more time, and that's one of the reasons for retiring, is not to quit, but be able to define for yourself what you want to do. And I was thinking the other day, I was doing some backfilling on our water supply, that there was one thing that I didn't miss about academic life, and that was grading papers, which takes an incredible amount of time. And because I'm not grading papers, I have a lot of time to do research. In fact, I'm doing an interesting paper, actually giving it tomorrow, which I call Why Nonviolence is Human, which attempts to integrate my studies of language, my studies of culture, my commitment to peace and justice studies, and uses an evolutionary perspective to show how humans have evolved nonviolent ways of getting along.
Could I throw in a Please. Comment about how I would look at things differently? I think one of the things from my perspective is that we have all, you know, you and all of us, been able to be very positive, very open to all kinds of things in the world when the political climate in this country was better than it is now. So during the 70s, it seems to me, even with Nixon, there was enough opposition to Nixon to create real excitement. And because of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, we were very intense, and the whole anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, we had a very intense involvement, not only in the world as a whole, but also at home. I think when Ronald Reagan came in, there was a kind of deadness that came over things that we've had trouble recovering from. And so to me, the excitement, it could have been youth, it could have been all kinds of things, just immediate post-colonial work or whatever. But the level of political discussion, the level of involvement, the openness of experimentation of America as a country and as a political system was very hopeful. The intense militarization that has gone on since the early 80s has driven us into a very, very sad period that we're trying to figure out, you know, exactly what went wrong, what are we doing now, et cetera. So.
Yeah. David, just on the, to complete the academic side, you invested quite a lot of time in the peace and justice studies at Michigan State. How did that arise in all this context?
I'm trying to remember the date, but Annabelle and I went to The Hague for the Hague Appeal for Peace. Was that
1999.
And one of the planks in this Hague Appeal for Peace, and actually Annabelle knows the history better than I, but it was essentially the 100th anniversary of...
The 1899 Hague Conventions, which were the first. They preceded or were part of all the Geneva Conventions that are being talked about.
So this was an attempt to rekindle that spark and interest. And one of the planks in their proposal was that peace education should be a component of every child's curriculum throughout the planet. And we started thinking about that and said, well, what's going on at Michigan State University? You're an educator. Shouldn't there be something in that area? So one day, and I'm terrible with dates, that it was a Martin Luther King anniversary date that was set aside for a Monday in which you were supposed to do peace and justice-oriented activities. So I called a bunch of people together and said, well, let's see what we can do here. And Dick Peterson in particular took this challenge very seriously, and he and I, with a lot of other people, too many to name, began to put together a specialization in peace and justice studies. A specialization is something like a master's, but I think it's somewhat unique to Michigan State. And since that time, I think we've had over 150 people in the program, of which about a third have already gotten their certificates. And the whole idea is to focus on peace, which we call active nonviolence. And I have to tell you a story if I can remember it. But peace is, we call active nonviolence, and justice is justice. And so what we really were arguing for is that we needed to emphasize in all of our courses this aspect of human existence. And I think there was the development of this program has encouraged not only students to get involved, but many faculty to increase the content of peace and justice in their curriculums throughout the university. The story I wanted to tell was a good friend of ours, Scott Whiteford, was at a meeting where our former president, Peter McPherson, was there. And he had gotten wind of peace and justice studies. And he said in his gruff way, peace and justice studies, that sounds communistic to me. And Scott was right on the spot. And he said, no, no, they're talking nonviolence. And he said, okay.
And Richard Peterson, now the chairman of philosophy department, and was as part of that, and continues to as chair of the peace and justice program as well at this time. Are there any final comments you'd like to make, David, about Michigan State and your feelings about having been a faculty member here for all the prime years of your career? And so.
I remember telling a graduate student that getting a PhD is really nothing but a license to learn. And I think that's so true, that thinking about what I knew when I got my PhD and what I've been taught by my colleagues, my teachers, and our students, that it has been a very, very wonderful opportunity to grow and learn and develop.
May I add something here again, too? I think, we, David, and we owe you personally an enormous thanks. Obviously, without your enormous commitment and your vision and your consistency and the right kind of approach to African studies, I don't think... And David couldn't have done anything. I certainly wouldn't have been particularly interested in staying around. So.
Well, thank you. Let's go back to the 70s again. When the two of you are together after your Peace Corps time in Cameroon and you come to East Lansing together?
Well, yes, eventually. It wasn't quite immediate like that, but yes, eventually. I actually started out in graduate school in anthropology here too, as well as sort of continuing the anthropology graduate work I was doing at the University of Arizona before we were married. But because of the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, we moved into university housing, and I immediately became very much involved in all the organizing that was going on.
And this, what year was this?
Well, this was 1967-68. So we were married in 66, and then we started having a family too. So Daphne took up a whole lot of time, but in any case, not that it was unpleasant, but being a mother, it was something new and very involving, of course. So we essentially, David was working on his degree, and I was organizing, and there are many aspects of that. In particular, it was just an extremely exciting time. It was very, very, very difficult because of the assassinations to keep a positive sort of spin on things. But the numbers of people involved and the numbers of really fundamental work that was being done to end the war in Vietnam, to continue the civil rights movement such that it really had an economic impact as well as a, you know, Voting Rights Act kind of impact, was a huge challenge. And then, you know, with all the Nixon nonsense, and Lyndon Johnson, you know, there was not the kind of there was an atmosphere of real involvement on many people's parts. So, and also the ability for people like me to not have a job but to actually organize. So we just, you know, sort of divided the work. Although we were also singing madrigals at the time, and we had built a harpsichord, and we did sort of a Capital Steps thing of having a madrigal rehearsal and then translating the words into political things and going around and singing that sort of thing. Anyway, we founded or helped found the Peace Education Center, which was just a coalition of local churches and groups that had peace emphasis from Women's International.
But that was in 1968.
Yeah, it was very early. It was also a part of a national movement. And then when the first...
The Peace Education Center was part
Of the national... Well, it was part of the Peace Council national movement. There was a Peace Council thing. But I think the really unique part about the Peace Education Center in the Greater Lansing area was that it was a coalition of local groups and did have connections with national stuff, but never got in debt, never was just an arm of a national group, a single national group, so that... even though it was more, it has been over the past whatever number of years, more or less effective, and we'll talk about the Southern Africa Liberation Committee, which was probably the most effective. It has maintained a presence. It has given people a chance to organize without reinventing the wheel all the time, and that we can go into in detail. I think that the other part of the organizing that we got into was environmental stuff during the first energy crisis and helped form Urban Options. And we were very involved in all the appropriate technologies work and the demonstrations and lived in a solar house here in East Lansing.
Your master's thesis was focused on...
Yeah, my master's thesis in urban planning was on urban options and on the organizing around
that. And designing energy-efficient communities.
Yeah, and we partly also inspired by all the selective purchasing and all the all the divestiture stuff, we designed the solar tax credits and mm-hmm. various things which allowed for all kinds of work to be done.
And then built which the was solar house.
Yeah, which was again canceled immediately by Reagan. So, you know, you have periods of progress, and then for some reason there is a much too much power on the part of a few individuals that seem to be recurring too. I wish they, you know, the Rumsfeld and the Cheneys and James Bakers of this world, they don't seem to go away. They seem to have a terrible impact. But anyway, that's sort of, I became a lawyer in part because of became very difficult to do any real grassroots organizing because all the funding for CETA programs or appropriate technology programs or any kind of real affirmative action work or, you know, were just eliminated. And besides, people always sort of refer to lawyers as the last gasp in a lot of things anyway. So anyway, and then I just got into the anti-nuclear work very specifically, both on a state level and on a national and international level.
To back up to the 1970s, mm-hmm. My understanding is that the Southern Africa Liberation Committee was formed under the Peace Education Center in 1972 mm-hmm. with the people involved being Bud Day, who was in the mm-hmm. a pastor in the United Ministries in Higher Education, and Carol Thompson, who was a political science graduate mm-hmm. student mm-hmm. at Michigan State, Bill Derman, who had come from University of Michigan and been part of the SDS mobilization, mm-hmm. And I'm not sure.
I think there was a Lovemore Nyoni, although I never met him.
I would like to take a step before that, actually, because we had gone to the GM stockholders meeting.
Peace Center.
It was actually...
From the Peace Education
Center. Well, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom People, but I was part of that group, and that was, you know, was a report on that meeting, which was very exciting, actually, that led to the formation of SOC, and Bud had an ability to have some money from the United Ministries to actually do staff work.
And the visit to General Motors meeting was in order to make what point?
Well, a stockholder's resolution to divest essentially
of General Motors' activity in South Africa.
And in apartheid South Africa. Right. So, I think that, you know, there was always we can get into this, but we were talking about it ourselves. My point of view, of course, about the SOC organizing came from a community organizer's angle as opposed to the experts in Africa angle, which Bill brought, and were very important, but they weren't opposed necessarily, but there was, there was a lot of really important organizing work that went on by the Beamans and by people in the Peace Education Center and by people like George Griffiths, who was mayor of East Lansing, related to the Selective Purchasing Act that came first in the city of East Lansing. You can't get something like that passed by a city council without real work and discussion
right,
with the city
that
council.
Was, I believe, late 1977.
But I mean, that's really where, when we finally got to the very good work that could be done locally to support the ANC, the African National Congress, and to the end of apartheid. Then we began to, you know, not ourselves discover mm-hmm. ways to do it, but to work by connecting local responsibility. And to me, that you know, if you're going to organize to change anything fundamentally like that, we can get into this more, but I think, as I was saying to David, none of us can forget that the real work, the end of apartheid, of course, was done in South Africa by the ANC. What people like Pat Beamon and Frank Beamon, I remember many times when they refused to compromise with the Sullivan principles or anything that would say anything less than the end of apartheid. And they really took leadership from the ANC, but then could translate the horrors of apartheid into, you know, pictures and booklets and attending every committee meeting and so on, so that people could understand not only that apartheid was unacceptable, but you could end it and that we could have a role in actually ending it. So it wasn't, it was a very important recognition on the part of all of us that the ANC was taking the real risks and the leadership, but at the same time that we could actually bring people locally, statewide, into an understanding that they could not have complicity with this kind of horror in good conscience. To me, that and developing ways that, you know, and of course you were involved very deeply in all that. But, from an organizer's point of view, the whole picture is really, really interesting and needs to be pursued, I think, in terms of where we go now with this.
I wanted to add that at its founding, there not only was South Africa with its apartheid, but there were also three Portuguese colonies of Guinea-Bissau, Mozambique, and Angola that were still under sort of white minority domination. And so I guess we stretched the word southern in Southern African Liberation because Guinea-Bissau is no way part of Southern Africa. But it was interesting that step by step that these Portuguese colonies were obtained their independence, and finally that left the focus on southern or South Africa. And I'm trying to remember when.
Southern Rhodesia was included as well, and Namibia as a hostage of
that's
South Africa
was
included in the in the priorities as well.
And I remember one of the SOC's activities was to get propaganda from the white minority Rhodesian, as it was called by the white minorities, propaganda, and then send it back to the independence groups in Zimbabwe. I think you were part of that too, David.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. It was a clipping service, I think, to clip all of the news about Southern African affairs for the Zimbabwe African National Union, Zimbabwe African People's Union, and that were in part of that. So the selective buying campaign by which the city of East Lansing voted that they would not purchase materials from corporations operating in South Africa, just to be clear about what that was one of the first city council actions in the United States. Mm-hmm. And then the next year, in 1978, then Michigan State becomes the first major public university to sell off its stockholdings in companies operating in South Africa, which, to the displeasure of some, included Kellogg, Dow Chemical, Clark Equipment in Kalamazoo, and the big three auto companies, and so on. Do you have particular memories of how that happened, that MSU, many people say this is a place of focus on land grant, on agriculture and education, why did MSU become early in that process?
I do remember one thing, which I think we were all involved. Actually, two things. There was something called the Sullivan Principles.
Well, that was later, wasn't it?
Was that later? I thought that was at the same time.
And it came in the late 70s as well.
Late 70s.
And the proposal was that the Reverend Leon Sullivan and his organization.
And that was a proposal by, I think it was a sincere proposal by Sullivan.
Who was on the General Motors Board of Directors.
Who worked on the General Motors. Who said that, well, if a corporation were to follow these rules of treating blacks the same as whites, and I forget all the details, that we wouldn't really need divestiture, we wouldn't need anything, that corporations would be an agent for change, and we really wouldn't have to do anything. Most of us were suspicious of that because it looked as though we were telling them to do what they have been doing, and there had been no change in the past. But it was somewhat of a red herring that distracted a lot of people, and that was one of the things that we had to fight. Another thing that came along was this notion of fiduciary responsibility, where I don't know who came up with it, but it was presented to the board that they could not make a decision to be selective in their investments, particularly if it would cost the university money. And so that sent us all off in a flurry about, well, what does this mean? And I think, Annabelle, you looked it up in the dictionary, in the law dictionary.
Well, I think the whole question of fiduciary responsibility, of course, is a major responsibility of the board. And it turned out, of course, that they actually were not being responsible by investing in corporations that relied on a hideously discriminatory system like apartheid.
Which to make profits, illegal labor practices in the United States.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, and in fact, so it turned out, of course, that we could demonstrate that they were going to do better financially by not investing in a system that was relying on something as unjust as, in fact, that was the case. So, but in part it was because there were the boycotts of going on and all the kind of work that happened. So, to go back to your question specifically about Michigan State, I just think because of the real interest in Africa on campus, a lot of people had really important experiences. We had worked together on everything from the civil rights movement through the things, very specific things like the selective purchasing. We had experts drawing. We also had enough community organizers to give the board the kind of information and the kind of constant nagging that we'd learned from getting city council. Again, there were key players, but there were a lot of players, so that and very knowledgeable people and people we could work on and work together fairly efficiently and easily. We knew how to work with the Board of Trustees. We knew what to do. We knew how to convince people of things, and so.
And in some ways, we're lucky in having a Republican elected member of the Board of Trustees to make the resolution for that MSU should divest in the board meeting in 78, which one doesn't always happen.
Well, and there were extremely exciting moments in all this, including the discussions that went on at that. Those meetings and the kind of backhanded stuff that the South African consulate had done from Chicago had done in relation to the Selective Purchasing Act, we knew what was going on, so we could counter and find out, what the other side was saying and be able to articulate why we were right. Although I say we sort of generously, because actually David and I didn't have a huge role. I think we had an important background kind of role, but people like Bud Day and Bill Derman and later on, or right then too, you yourself and
Pat and Frank, Eric Williams and others there, right?
Yeah, but they,
Well, there are some other interesting names.
Well, tell the student union story.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to mention Malcolm IIX, Milt Taylor, Jerry Bennett, Barb Teeble, Jerry Kleiss, Paula Whatley. Mm-hmm. Remember her? Mm-hmm. At different times there were these very energetic people that... and I think what was so interesting, that each person brought with them their own talents and their own way of going about things. That some people like to work locally. What was her name? Diane Fugrad?
Fugrad.
She was able to get a grant from the Graduate Something Council?
Council on Graduate Studies.
Something. Anyway, she got money for a film series at one point. Paula was connected with WKAR and got some programs going. I know you were more comfortable working with the people downtown in Lansing. And so different people were doing different things. And I call it sort of a cooperative anarchy. Maybe the cooperative is redundant, but it wasn't a matter of any kind of central organizing. It was people getting together and agreeing that, well, this is what I can do, this is what you can do. It made it so effective.
And around the state, there were small committees in a local church, in a county government, et cetera, which are raising issues, which gave the impression to political economic powers that there were thousands and thousands of people organized on the issue. So there was some impression management going on as well in all of this.
It went impression management, but also there were, you know, to again go back to the Peace Center a little bit, I have all these memories of Barb Thibault and working with Pat Beam and just putting together packets and pictures and display boards and being at every meeting that was relevant, that anybody was talking about any of this stuff with the right kind of materials at the right time. And it, you know, Pat was relentless and
tireless,
but I mean in just collecting the stuff. And I'm sure it was not the easiest person in the world to work with all the time, but still it was an important kind of role, and that you know helped create the impression that there actually was some real grassroots demand for proper behavior.
Right.
So
and they had all of these projects, like every, I can't remember, I think it was Friday evening that they would show a film. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they were the only two people there, sometimes there were 20 people there, but they did it rain and shine week after week after week. They also had a photographic exhibit, which I think was very moving, that they would put up in the International
Center. From the International Defense and Aid in the UK. Right? That's where they
and
got the pictures.
They did that again, week after week after week. And one other project, which I think was, I don't know whether it was Pat or Frank's creativity, but across from the Union, there was a place where you could hang a banner, which usually said, you know, welcome class of 42, or something like that.
Or Rush or, Sigma Chi or something.
Yeah, you know, like join the bash or something like that. Well, Frank got the idea that we could encourage the Board of Trustees to support divestiture. And so every Friday we'd go over there, and Frank had a ladder that we'd climb up and hoist this banner up there. And that went on for several weeks.
That said divest from apartheid South Africa or something.
Yeah. And I think Frank's version of this is a little different from mine. I think yours is a little different too. But essentially we got a letter from the Union Programming Board saying that that we no longer could put that banner up because the union didn't want political signs up there. And, of course, political is an interesting word, and it's one of the things I like to explore when I do language and ideology studies. Political really means not what you would expect it to mean of engaging in the politics of the day, but more political is something that's sort of against the grain of the ambient thinking. So it occurred to us, and nobody quite knows who it occurred to, maybe just jointly, that if we asked them to define political, they could not do it in a way that would exclude us without excluding everything else. So we asked them, can you tell us what political is so we know what kind of sign we could put up? And we were notified later that it would be all right to put that banner up again.
Well, there were all kinds of things then when it came to the McGough-off stuff too that were fun. We had little stickers that were inspired by the ones that the Wobblies put up, you know, early in the last century. That just said McGough off, and they went all over campus. But you know, we could talk about the McGough off thing, but of course you've been into this, I'm sure, with other people. But you know, my little story about those little stickers was that we decided to make little stickers, and instead of just having them square, we cut them with pinking shears, so they had this sort of star-like quality. But then the city of East Lansing also passed an ordinance that prohibited us from putting them up, so you know, we just kept putting them up. And I just want to make one other point about things like that. The whole success of the selective purchasing divestiture has resulted in a lot of real problems of the law related to this kind of work. Because the right came back and challenged a lot of these things, and now, as I understand it, for example, it's only possible to invest in a positive way rather than divest from a negative way. So if you're talking about militarism, for example, or environmentally sound product, these kinds of things or what came out of the anti-apartheid work, and in fact specifically the TIAA Kreft Social Choice Fund, which does not invest in any weapons at all, and no nuclear power, and no environmentally unsound or unfair labor practices. Corporations that do all those things, and now there's also something about tobacco, I think, that came in with that. That got sort of shunted off in a corner, and although many of us have invested in the social choice as part of our retirement stuff, people don't quite understand, the role that the anti-apartheid movement had in trying to end militarism now, for example, or, what the right did to squash the kind of grassroots efforts that need to be made in order to, for this society even now, to survive economically or morally or legally, for that matter. So I think it's more than just the story of the successful anti-apartheid movement.
And it's a fitting touch that the MSU divestiture, when tracked against the normal divestiture, actually did better for the university than a traditional investment would be. We learned not so long ago that the Kreft Social Choice is outperforming the standard investment as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So sometimes being on the right side is...
Well, no, I mean, but that's one of the arguments. Until it is economically... it's not going to be changed just for moral and right. legal reasons.
So the with the end of apartheid, and we have with Mandela out of prison and elected as president in 1994, the Portuguese territories having Portuguese rule having collapsed in 1975. Rhodesia becomes Zimbabwe in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
What happens to the African activism and the focus on African issues with all of this?
Well, as I alluded to, I think the focus has to be on an end to militarism. I think it was you I heard talk about what happened in Liberia. You talked about, not personally, but I think I heard you at WKAR explaining the way Liberia got in the mess it got in, which was because Reagan dumped weapons in to try to get Taylor to stop having slightly leftist rhetoric so he could save a CIA transmitter. I mean, you know, I think that's right. Maybe I'm misquoting you, but it's clearly necessary to end the weapons trade to you know, and any reliance on nuclear weapons or nuclear power to try to make sure that South Africa doesn't rely on nuclear power, or that you know, we can get beyond the idea of putting money into weapons and put it into healthcare and education and all the rest of it. That will, but this is also a fundamental challenge, and it's a challenge which the ANC took up in relation to apartheid, which we in the United States have not yet taken up in relation to the end of militarism. We you know, so that's I think economically it's now quite clear that we're not going to survive unless we stop putting $500 billion a year into weapons of war, and start putting that money into environmental cleanup and real sustainable society stuff. But it will take very serious organizing work on the part of all of us, and it's quite scary.
The Chronicle for Higher Education this last week has reported a significant rise in student activism on campuses.
That's
which
great.
We're seeing at Michigan State with several different groups mobilizing interest on Darfur crisis in the Sudan,
mm-hmm.
Not on anything else in Africa, but on mm-hmm. on that issue. And I'm just wondering, is this a do you have advice, having watched one particular cycle of activism on racial discrimination and authoritarian rule in Southern Africa, for those who come now to look at the global change?
Yeah, well, I do. I think I just more or less said it. That you cannot stop what's going on, for example, in Darfur, by putting in more weapons or by pretending that you could, violence is going to stop violence. Somebody has to look into the core reasons for the crisis, and part of it is just arms supply, but part of it is drought, part of it is oil, I presume part of it is starvation, part of it is land. You know, there can be huge projects for land reclamation, for real taking care of refugees. The refugee problem in the world is enormous. For environmental degradation problems, so, you know, there are all kinds of reasons to think that global warming has helped cause the problems of drought in that part of Africa. I think that the students need to be looking at these fundamental questions and talking about the end of militarism and the end of that, not believing that war is going to stop war or that weapons supply is going to.
I didn't catch your question, David.
Well, I'm just asking for the new generation of students who want to mm-hmm. to mobilize on Africa, which we're seeing on campus now. You know, a large black sorority invites people over to talk about Sudan and so on, and there seems to be a new cycle of student interest in social justice questions.
Yeah, I think there is. I don't know if there's any new advice, but I do recall Noam Chomsky, talking about really our generation when in the 60s we started getting involved politically, and that was that there had been such a lack of activism over a number of years, we really didn't have the mentors. And I think that these kids are not so far past that generation, that they have parents and grandparents that actually can sort of walk them through that, and they don't have to discover the wheel all over again. But I am delighted to see the range of interest that these students are taking, not only Darfur, but economic justice, which is, I think, a really interesting concept. And that group has been very active on campus for any number of years. And then there's a group called ECO that's involved in ecological stuff. And I still get their emails, and they seem to still be active, even though the founders of these groups have long since graduated.
Good. Well, as you look back over these years and from your retirement home in Upper Michigan now, any last words of comment on this life and this mm-hmm. this history that you've had here?
I'm waiting for Annabelle to say something.
Well, I never thought I'd be in East Lansing, Michigan for 40 years when we were married. I've had a very interesting time, and we've obviously had a very rewarding, happy marriage, and now have 5 grandchildren. You know, a lot of it has been association with people like yourself, and it hasn't always been easy in a lot of, you know, sort of political ways and personal ways and all sorts of things, but I think that we have had the opportunity, all of us, to engage in very meaningful work, and to the extent that we've been able to do it together, it's been as marvelous as life can be and should be. And you know, I'm very thankful about it, as well as apprehensive, in the sense of feeling that I need to figure out what the next steps should be for us in terms of involvement. And it's not so easy to figure those out now as it was earlier. Not because we're isolated or anything, but because of the times.
One of our favorite scenes in The Meaning of Life is when they, during the plague, they start
the
bringing
Monty
out
Python
the dead,
movie.
Bring out your dead, and they bring somebody out. And he says, "Why, I'm not dead yet." Of course, then they pop him over the head. But that's the way we feel about retirement. We're not dead yet. We just don't have to grade papers anymore. And we have become part of a newly formed group in Mackinac City called the Great Lakes.
Straits Area Concerned Citizens for Peace and Justice. We're trying to stop the what are they called? The free fire safety zones that the Coast Guard is now doing live fire all over the Great Lakes. I mean, this is the kind of complete insanity that you get when you spend $500 billion on military crap. I mean, it's just distracting. It's incredibly stupid, and so that's that. You know, with that kind of perspective, I'm not sure.
There's always something coming along, so we're not too worried that there will be nothing to do. I guess we'd be happy if there were nothing to do.
Well, it sounds like your motto could well be that Portuguese phrase that was used in the liberation movements: "A luta continua."
Absolutely.
The struggle continues.
Absolutely.
So, David Dwyer, Annabelle Dwyer, thank you very much for your years with us and your contributions to this university and to this community and to the world. Thank
Our
you.
Pleasure. For
well, thank here. You, David, and thank you for doing this, because it's kind of nice for us to have have this chance.
Now we don't have to remember anymore. You know, it's all recorded.
Yeah, now we don't have to save all those papers. Look at the voice library.